Broadcasting from the campus of Maharshi University of Management, you are listening to OE 90.5 FM and to the program What's New on Campus, hosted by Dr. Kathy Guarini, Dean of Faculty here at Maharshi University of Management, and yours truly, Stan Stansbury. And today we are very fortunate to have as our special guest Norman Zierold, currently in media relations here on campus. Author of many books, including That Reminds Me, his masterpiece recently, and one that has rocketed him to fame here on campus and in Fairfield. And Dr. Guarini, Norma's latest book, That Reminds Me, obviously is skillfully and well written, shows how writing seems to flourish in our community, an enormous case in such a unique and delightful way, don't you think?
Absolutely. And the beautiful thing about this book is it draws on all of Norman's experiences. I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. We all read autobiographies, and this is somewhat of an autobiography. And I've always thought I would never write one, because so often when I read an autobiography, you know, I tend to be a little critical of the person and think, you know, either they're egotistical or they're wrong-headed, or it's just very easy because you see them trying to portray themselves in a positive light, and in that way they show all their failings. And when I read this, I didn't feel that at all. I just felt completely like you were being genuine, and that you are genuine. And I can't believe that you did that by contriving what you wrote, or being, you know, having a certain impression of how you wanted to convey yourself. So how exactly did all these reminiscences come about?
Now, I'm so glad you asked that, because one of the reasons that I'm glad that I wrote the book is that I think I can give suggestions about how anyone that reads this book can write their own book, because the way you do it is you start putting something down on paper, or if you want to talk it into it, whatever, you know, speaker or something, but start and then do not censor yourself. Start writing and put down, and then what comes next, and whatever it reminds you of, put down what it reminds you of, and continue and continue. And you'll don't say, oh, well, I could have said this a little better. Don't stop to correct yourself. You could make it better, but don't do it now, because then you'll interrupt your rhythm. Mm-hmm. And my theory is that everyone, when I went over my own experiences, I thought, these are not so different from anyone else's. Everyone has had a whole life, and there are all these different people that have entered, and all these different things that have happened, and many of them would be of interest to other people. So I think everyone has one book in them, if not more, but evidently, definitely has one. That doesn't mean that you never necessarily have a bestseller in you, but you have a good story there. And, you know, there are shifting tastes in time. Something that will be very favorably received today, 3 years ago, no one would have been interested, or 10 years from now, they won't. So don't despair if you don't succeed right away. Just keep plodding away, and eventually you'll find someone that's on the same vibratory role that you're on. And so just keep on. But do that thing, and I think that if you let the associations come, you can then, you'll go from subject to subject to subject, which my book, That Reminds Me, I call it a conversational memoir, as you know, it's a subtitle. And so you'll think of one thing, and it's something completely different it'll remind you of. But don't say, oh, it has nothing to do with it. It does have something to do with it. You just thought of it. That's what it has to do with it. So just keep going, going, going. And you might be amused by something that... the other thing I'd like people to learn from this is something that I learned and that I talk about in the book, as I remember. Craig Pearson, the president, acting president of the university.
Executive vice president.
Always liked this example that I gave, because I taught Project Right for a while, 10 years ago, and to students from other countries. And when I gave those that example, he said he always uses that when he himself is dealing with someone. And that was, at one point, and this is in That Reminds Me, I was asked to, let me just tell it the way it happened. I got a phone call. I was living in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, and it was a voice that said, "This is Marjorie Looney." And I said, "Oh," and I thought, "Marjorie Looney." And I started laughing a bit. And she said, "I'm Anthony Quinn's secretary, the actor Anthony Quinn, who you may remember from Zorba the Greek, which is probably his most best-known film."
Many movies.
Many movies. Over 60, he told me. But she said he has written a memoir, his life story, and he's had it for 20 years with Little Brown, the publisher, a very good publisher. And they have looked at it, and they can't, it's 1,000 pages, and they can't find anyone to make it work. It doesn't work. 1,000 pages are just don't work. And they said they tried many editors and spent a lot of money on it, and it was still 1,000 pages, and it was still a jumble. And so they said, "Will you give it a try?" And I said, "Absolutely." And so I met Anthony Quinn, who's a big man, broad bone, and that terrific voice. And the voice, by the way, has a special story behind it, too, which I'll tell you. But he brought in, we talked for 2 hours, and just one story after another. Every time he told a story, I thought of something. And then when I thought of something, he thought of it. We had both met Garbo experiences to tell, for example. And so I finally, after our 2 hours together, he said, "Well, I'm perfectly happy working with you. How about you?" And I said, "Well, I'd have to see the manuscript." And he plunked down 1,000 pages this high, you know. And I said, "As soon as I'm finished with it, I'll let you know." Well, I read it through in a 24-hour period, because I skipped a lot, because I knew what was being repeated. And I saw that it was 1,000 pages because he had repeated himself the way people do when they're writing something. They tend to repeat the same thing, and if they see someone else later in the day, they may say the same things again. So we're always repeating and repeating. And so I said, "I'll work on it with you." And we would sit down, and I would go and cross out this and cross out that. And I thought we'd cut it in half to about 500, and then I was still going on it. And we did this day after day in a little resort in Death Valley that he loved to go to, where we worked in this kind of idyllic atmosphere. And finally, one day, I thought, and I was crossing out something else, and I thought, "You know, he's half Mexican and he's half Irish. He won't take much more of this. I think I'd better be careful." So I started going through the pages, and I was a little more careful, and I thought, "Well, let this one slip." Suddenly he said, "Wait," and he crossed it out. And I knew then that he knew what he knew how to edit. And one day, and he would go along with everything I crossed out. And then one day, I crossed out something, which an anecdote that I just thought it was kind of, it was a true anecdote, but it was tasteless. I didn't want to put that on in anyone's consciousness. I didn't want to have that on everyone's.
And you were a meditator at that point.
I was, yes. And so I let it go, and then he reached right over and he crossed it out. That's when I knew that he had picked up the whole craft of editing. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. No longer with us, of course, at this stage. But one of his last, he married late in life and had two children by a very delightful young woman, Danish born, I believe. And she called me up, and he passed on, but she said she was going to do an oral history of him and get people who knew him to talk about him. And she said she'd love to talk to me, of course. So I told her to read the book to get a beginning, you know. So there we are. So that led to one other thing that Craig Pearson liked so much. The fact that 2 years later, or two or three or 4 years later, Little Brown called me and said, "Well, we want you to do another book." And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "We have Rex Harrison, you know, in our stable of authors, or would-be authors, and we wonder if you'd be interested in working with him and doing the same thing." And I said I would be very much interested. And they said, "Well, it would mean going to the Italian Riviera where he lives, and you'd be holed up in the wonderful town of, I think it was Ravello, or is it Ravello on the Italian Riviera?"
I think so.
I think it was one of the most beautiful towns on the Riviera. "And there you will get," and so they said, "Very good," and they offered me $600 a week, and I said, "No, it'll have to be $1,000. And they said, "Why so much?" And I said, "Because you paid me too little the last time around." And they did say that was all right. But then here was the interesting thing. I was sent to London to meet with him first and his agent. So his agent picked me up, and we went to see him in his beautiful house, Georgian house in a fashionable area of London. And there he was. Do you know Rex Harrison at all? From films?
The movies,
yeah. Yeah, from films. Well, as you know, he's a tall man, and he's commanding, and he's tremendously gracious, and you know, he's a gentleman of the old English school. And I came into the room, and there were these six or seven or eight dogs, pugs, these great big things lying on the floors. I just couldn't believe that anyone would want to have so many dogs. And I mean, panting away like that. But we had about a wonderful 2-hour conversation, just as I'd had with Quinn. And at the end of it, he said, "They tell me you worked with Anthony Quinn on his memoir." And I said, "Yes, I did." I said, "He gave me 1,000 pages, and we turned them in, and I turned them into 300. And Rex Harrison looked at me and he said, "Aha! And here we have the opposite," he said. "I have 50, and we'll have to turn it into 300. And I said, "Oh, not to worry," I said. "We'll flesh it out with theatrical anecdotes." And he said, "Oh, I loathe theatrical anecdotes." And I said there to myself, yeah, "There goes the book." And the next day, the agent picked me up. We had a meeting, and he had told me, by the way, I think you're in his employ now because he liked you very much. In the morning, he called me up, and he said, "You know, I don't know how to explain this, but he's chosen someone else to do the book." And I said, "Oh." And I said, "What do you think happened?" "Oh, by the way, I must tell you, I was very glad to hear this, because I was supposed to go to the Italian Riviera during our 2-hour talk Harrison told me that he was not going to the Italian Riviera. He had signed on to do a Pirandello play in the eastern, northeastern United States. That means that he'd be, and I'd be going
like
with
New
him.
Like New York and Boston and Syracuse
and Pittsburgh,
Buffalo,
and Scranton. and I'd be in a hotel room sitting there working on this stuff in these industrial towns and these towns. I mean, it didn't look like the fun experience at all that I had in mind, you know. I mean, what would I do all day sitting in a room, you know? It couldn't go to the beach. And in Scranton, what are you going to do? He was in all these Pennsylvania towns. And so I was just, I thought the night before, how will I explain that I can't do this with him? And then in the morning it all resolved itself, and I pretended to be a little miffed, but I let it pass. You know,
so there was some determinism involved in there from the outside.
From the outside. Yeah. I thought I was doing it, you know, and it was all being handled for me. But it was just wonderful, and so I didn't have to... the reason, by the way, that he didn't... I asked, why do you think he chose someone else? And he said, well, I was quite young at the time, and Rex was my age and older, much older. But he had just married a young girl of 22. And the agent said, I don't think he wants a young man in the house for 6 months, you know. And so it all worked out beautifully. That was a wonderful experience, though, just the same.
Yeah,
and I got my... I was only employed for 2 weeks, but I did get the $2,000.
Of course, of the going over and reading the book and everything.
Right,
the 50 pages.
Yeah, and of course, I had made gotten a round-trip ticket, which, of course, they paid for, too. And so I just stayed for 6 weeks and toured the continent.
Now, in your book, Norman, you mentioned that you were, you became an interviewer of famous people in Hollywood. How did that happen? How did you come upon that?
Yes, well, the first book I ever wrote, you know, I went to, first of all, you know, I'm from the Amana colonies, which everyone in Fairfield, I think, knows. It's only about an hour from here. But it was an idyllic, rural, small town, spiritual community, and still is, only now it's not so much communal. It's still communal, but it's modern, it's entrepreneurial. It has a woolen mill and a furniture factory and a lot of tremendous number of good restaurants and tourists.
A lot of tourists, yes.
Yeah, a lot of tourists. A great, great many tourists. So I came from there, and I went to... it seems an odd place to have developed a desire to become a writer and work for Theater Arts in New York, Theater Arts Magazine. But, you know, even in Amana, which was a little rural community, there was a very good library, and there was Theater Arts Magazine, which I read. And some years later, when I got to New York, the first thing I did was to see whether I could get a job at Theater Arts. Imagine that, coming from the Amana community, which was so different, with no experience at all. I thought, it never occurred to me that would be a problem, that I couldn't get a job. But in New York, it's very like that. You know, when you get there, they say you're underexperienced. The moment you've had an experience and want to change, they say you're overexperienced. So it's a tricky place. And in any event, I did get an interview with the advertising director. They said there's no opportunity for you in editorial, and but the advertising director will see you, and he has no openings for you, but he'll see you. So I went in and saw this nice man, Ellis Myers, who had been with the founder of Playboy magazine, Hugh Hefner. They were both together at the beginning, and then they had, of course, it went on to be one of the great, great money makers of all time. And Hugh Hefner, of course, was in charge, and they had a falling out. And so he fell up. He had a falling out just before it went to the sky, you know. So he and he landed at Theatre Arts, which kind of was on its way out, actually. But he told me to call him every month. So I did call him every month. And each month he would say, nothing's happening. Still no job. And he said, next time, he said, save your dime. This was an era of a dime phone call. And so I thought the next month, well, why do it? He said not to. And I said, but it's only a dime. So I put in a dime. And I said, this is Norman Zerold calling again. And he said, how quickly can you get over here? Isn't that the way serendipity
works? A little free will.
Yeah,
that one
another
was
free
there.
Will. So there I was. And then one thing happened after another. And they let him go because, the magazine changed hands, and the new management couldn't afford him. You know, he had good salary. And they asked him who he recommended to take his place. And here, after 6 months, he said, my assistant, Norman Zerold. And by the way, in those 6 months, I had learned how to do advertising. I knew all that I thought was necessary. So they hired me and made me advertising director after 6 months. Little guy from a manor that didn't know beans about anything in magazine work. Here I was, you know, going to the theater every night. It was just hallucinatory. And in a couple of months they said, but, you know, Norman, the advertising hasn't picked up much since you've been paid advertising director. What is holding us up? And I said, circulation. We don't have enough circulation. We have only 30,000, and advertisers want to reach millions. And they said, well, would you take over circulation? And I said, of course I would take over. Imagine the chutzpah to say, I will take over circulation. And so I did. And of course, I asked for a raise with all these new duties. And
so you were doing both advertising and at the same time.
At the same time, and 3 months later,
well,
they
said, "Well, you deserved a raise."
Yeah, I did. And 3 months later, they said, "Now here's a problem, Norman. We like you very much, but you know, circulation hasn't gone up." And they said, "You know, will you take?" Oh, I did. I already say, "Will you take over circulation?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're doing both, but circulation hasn't gone up, and advertising hasn't gone up.
Right, and so they said, "Why has circulation not gone up now that you've been doing it for 3 months?" I said, "Because the editorial is not as strong as it should be. We need more trendy things, more zip, more creativity. And they said, would you take over? Well, it was hallucinatory. So I had become the editorial director and advertising director. Oh, I was so happy there that I could hardly leave the office in the evening. We had such fun. And it became a very, very much, you know, highly respected magazine, wonderful things. That's where I ran into people like Andy Warhol and so on, you know, because the art director of our magazine left at one point, and I had to find a new art director, and I said, well, who should I call? And this friend of mine said, there's a young man who's just starting out. His name is Andy Warhol. He's doing windows for I. Miller Shoes. That's what he was getting his salary from, you know. I. Miller Shoes. But he's going to be big at some point. And he might be interested. He'd have 32 pages of a magazine, art magazine, theater arts magazine. It'd be fun for him to do. So I called up. You see, I never thought there was any reason why not to do this. So I called up Andy Warhol, and it was Andy Warhol. And we talked for half an hour, and at the end of that time, he said, "Norman, it's a temptation, but I really don't want to do 32 pages of theater artwork every month. But thanks for calling." And so someone said to me, "Well, you know, you should we had an opera, a screen magazine." No, what am I saying? Theater Arts was for the theater, and we had a film issue every year. And so I wanted to do something that was really that would really create attention. So I said to someone who was in that field, and I said, "What should I do that would be different?" He said, "Get a film that Charlie Chaplin made called Monsieur Verdú, and that has never been published. It's a terrific film, and it's never been published. And I don't know why. Why don't you find out?" And so I just called the operator, and I had heard that he was in Switzerland, and I thought, if it's Switzerland, everyone will know. And I just called the operator and said, "Long distance, please, and could I speak to Charlie Chaplin? Could you call Charlie Chaplin for me?" The phone rang, and a man's voice answered, and I said, "Could you put me through to Mr. Chaplin?" And he said, "This is Mr. Chaplin." So it's just one thing after another like that. So that answers in part your question of how I got to meet these various people. It was just, I mean, there's Rex Harrison, there's after another couple of months at the magazine, that management changed again. And we were all laid off, everyone, except one or two. And so I thought, well, now I have my chance to write a book. And I decided that I would write a book. And should I tell you how I came to write it?
Yes, please.
Well, I had thought for a long time that I would like to write a book in a manner. I used to think as I was walking along that I'd like to write a book, and I'd write little things like when my Aunt Emma, my favorite aunt, died, I wrote a little thing about it, and I just wrote little things like that, but I never wrote for anyone. But I thought, well, here, now you've got unemployment insurance for 6 months, now you could maybe just write a book. And what would I write about? And I had a friend named Marguerite Young. Marguerite Young was a novelist in New York, and I met her in Iowa City. She was working with the Writers' Workshop there, which is very famous, as you know. It has employed all the great writers of our time at different times. And I thought it would be wonderful to write a book. And I would tell Marguerite, who was, after all, coaching writers, and she'd always say, "What do you want to write about?" And I'd give her some idea for a novel about this and that, and she'd say, "Norman, you're theater arts, you're having all these free lunches that people invite you to. You take me to these free lunches." It's true, you know, when you...
Because of the publicity of the magazine.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you get invited around, you know, because people would want to be mentioned and so on. So that all worked wonderfully. And she'd always say, "You're having a good time, you're well paid, you like doing it." But I've been let go. And she said, "Find another editorial job, you'll have no problem." And so I would go to her and say, "I'd want to do this and I want to do that." And she'd say, it was always fiction. I always thought it'd be wonderful to write a novel. And she'd say, "No, Norman, stay where you can. I got another job." And So one day I went to another job, which was very interesting. A show magazine hired me on the basis of my vast experience as a circulation director. They needed a circulation director badly. And so I did that, and then that magazine went out of business again. It was owned, by the way, by Huntington Hartford, who was the A&P, Huntington Hartford, A&P heir. And it was a very interesting year that I had there, actually, because to be hired there, you had to pass inspection with him. He was into whatever this is called when you study how a person writes. Calligraphy?
It's something else.
Not phrenology, that's the head, I think. In any event, you study your hand. So everyone had to write that sentence, and Hunt would look it over, and if he saw that you registered good qualities, your one sentence, you were hired. And so I evidently passed muster. But then after a year, the magazine just... It was a wonderful magazine, but it came along at the wrong time, I think. And he didn't want to spend any more money on it. Huntington Hartford had this tendency to want to do one interesting thing after another and to launch it, and then to let it go and drop it just when it was taking hold. He had Paradise Island. He bought Paradise Island, which is now a great big resort center in the Caribbean, I believe. And then he sold it just before there was a great vogue for that type of tourism. So he sold the magazine, and then finally I went to Marguerite, and she said, "Well, what is it this time that you want to write about?" And I said, "I'd like to write a book about the child stars, about Mickey Rooney, Shirley Temple, Judy Garland, Deanna Durbin, Freddie Bartholomew." She said, "Stop," she said, "just do it." She said, she knew that there was a market for that book. That's why she didn't want me to go into fiction. There you may have to go a long road before you have a market developed, people who like your writing. If you're writing about child stars, everyone who likes child stars will be interested.
Everybody who goes to the movies.
Yeah. And like Newsweek did a whole page on my book, you know, because it's news when someone writes about some people in the news. So that was, you asked the question, you know, how I came to write these various books. Once you write one, you're on a track. After that, the child stars, that was great, great fun. I wrote the whole thing in the New York Public Library.
Now, you became friends with many, many Hollywood stars and famous people, including Barbara Walters, I think you mentioned her.
Yeah.
She was an episode in your life.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, Barbara was one of the best people I met. She was then on the Today Show, NBC, and she was one of the anchors, I think one of the real pioneers of lady anchors. And as I remember it, we met at, that was a book, I wrote, first of all, I'll just briefly mention that after I wrote the child stars, I got on the Hollywood thing and wrote a book called The Moguls, about the heads of the studios, Louis B. Mayer and Jack Warner and so on and so forth. That was, McCall's magazine printed a part of that, so it was quite successful. And then I was offered whether I would write a biography of Greta Garbo, because someone had written a book about Marlene Dietrich, and they thought, well, why not Garbo? So I wrote one about Garbo. And so I wrote three or four books about Hollywood. And then I decided, Marguerite was wonderfully interesting. She liked all these unsolved mysteries, crimes. And she thought I should write a whole book on unsolved mysteries. Well, you know, the trouble with unsolved mysteries is that they're unsolved.
You know? So there's no final chapter.
No final chapter. And but Marguerite suggested that, and I wrote one, not on the whole range of them, but I wrote a whole book about one unsolved mystery. There, in 1874, in Philadelphia, there was a young little boy of 4 years old, kidnapped, and no one had ever been kidnapped for ransom before. They may have been kidnapped in local situations or so, but not nationally, not on a big scale. But this little boy, 1874, was 2 years before the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, 1776, 1876. And this little boy, Philadelphia, was preparing for this tremendous centennial. And this little boy of 4 years old was, you know, kidnapped. And so everyone forgot about everything else. This little boy was, the kidnappers established a correspondence and they asked for a ransom, and the authorities told the parents, you can't do it. If you do, everyone will be kidnapping children. So they didn't, even though their hearts broke, you know, they couldn't ransom their boy. And after a while, they couldn't not do it, so they said they would. And by then it was too late. The thing had fallen through. And so I wrote a book about that, and the New York Times reviewed it and elsewhere. And Barbara Walters on the Today Show interviewed me for it. Well, this was big news in the Amana colonies, you know. Late native son gets interviewed by Barbara Walters, so everyone was by their set, of course. And I went to the studio, and I'll tell you the part that you thought was amusing. I got there, and you know, you have to go way, way ahead of time. It was had to go there very early in the morning and go through, you know, you get made up and this and that and the other thing. And Barbara, then I went in to see Barbara, and she said, oh, hello, she said. I haven't read your book, she said. I haven't had time, she said. So we'll have to wing it, she said. And she handed me a sheet, and she said, these are the questions that the staff prepared for me. What do you think? And so I looked at it, and she said, well, and I said, well, they're kind of boring. These questions are kind of boring. And she said, I thought so, and tore them in shreds, you know. And she said, what do you want me to ask you? So that all went very, very well. And so we were chatting and we were chatting. As we were chatting, I thought I noticed, we were sitting right next to each other, across from each other. I noticed her leg pressing against mine. And I thought, so early in the morning. We were, you know, we were about the same age, and of course she is attractive, and I was passably attractive in my youth. And so I thought, well, but I'm not sure. So if I press back, and she isn't pressing it, she'll give me a lousy review. But if she is doing it, and I don't respond, she'll give me an even worse review. And so, interview, that is. So I, just as I was thinking these thoughts and thinking how to handle this dilemma at 6:30 in the morning, and as I was thinking that, she said, Norman, you feel my leg pressing against yours? And I said, yes, Barbara. And she said, when I do that, it means we're breaking for a commercial. Finish your sentence and take no less than 30 seconds.
And so did she do that, and did you take no less than 30 seconds?
That's right. It worked out exactly that way. And she gave me a wonderful interview. And she told me afterwards, she said, we should have had another segment for you. But of course, they schedule it in advance, and it had to be done the way it was. And then we chatted, and we had the most delightful chat. She had been married to a man who was a producer, and he had produced Judy Garland's farewell tours. You know, she did every now and then when she needed a little extra money, she went on a farewell tour, comeback tour. And so she told me that when she met Judy, Judy was complaining about her mother, you know, and the fact that her mother had put her on, you know, the studio had put her on drugs to keep her awake during all this filming as a child, you know, and the mother, of course, went along with it because, you know, in those days, this was 50, 60 years ago, these amphetamines and things like that,
nobody knew what was going to happen.
No. So everyone was doing that, and the studio would give her pills to keep her going, to keep her awake during the day, and then they'd have to put her to sleep at night with sleeping pills. And the mother okayed that, and Judy held it against her later on because she never could get over
the dependency.
Barbara told me she thought, yes, it's all true. But, you know, at a certain point, we all have to forgive our parents and, if not forgive them, accept, you know, and let go of all that. And so we had this wonderful conversation and just went on and on. And I recently, when I wrote the book, because I mentioned this, I sent her a copy with telling her to check it out. So I sent that to her and... By the way, I did it at the time. I told the story to Reader's Digest, which at that time was really big. Everyone was reading Reader's Digest, 18 million circulation. And they ran it in a column they had called Personal Glimpses. And I got another nice bunch of money for that.
Well, Nora, amidst all this adventuring glamour of Hollywood, how did you come into transcendental meditation? It seems like these two paths are a little bit distant from each other, but maybe they're not.
Well, they ran into one another. It's very, very true. The thing is, in past years, when I was young, I had no interest whatsoever in Far Eastern religions and this talk of unity and so on and so forth. To me, it was just jargon. I had just no interest in it at all. But then what happened was I had my writing career. So I had all that experience of life in the relative. And at a certain point, life in the fast lane takes its toll. You know, the cocktail hour does finally become monotonous, though it does take a long time for it to become monotonous. But in any event, I had written about as much as I'd cared. All that was fine. And I had various assignments that took me to the West Coast, and I left the fast lane in New York to get to Los Angeles, but I found the fast lane was pretty well established there too, so it was the same cocktail hour and the same fast lane. And after a while I thought, you know, Norman, there has to be more to it than this. It's fun to have, to get an unnatural but very pleasant high, but there must, but then to pay for it with, tough days following. So I thought that there must be something else, and I thought I'll move out of Los Angeles, and I moved to a little town called Laguna Beach, one of the most beautiful places in the world, about an hour south of Los Angeles. And I was just walking, after about a week there, I was walking along, and on a telephone pole I saw a poster, and it said Maharishi Mahesh Yogi Transcendental Meditation. So I went to this, and I went into a private house, which where this meeting was taking place, and there was a young man of 17 or 18, and he seemed, and a group of people waiting for him, apparently, to talk, and then he talked, and it was evidently, it had said, the poster had said, Transcendental Meditation as taught by Maharshi, didn't say that he would be there. So this young boy spoke for half an hour, and I thought, God, he seems happy, he seems peppy, and he said, and then I thought, why don't I do it if I can be that peppy and happy? And so I went. Oh, then a couple of weeks later, I thought, I'd like to start now, but I didn't remember anyone's name, and there seemed to be no place to go to find out. When a car stopped as I was walking along the street and said, you were at that lecture, weren't you, the other day? And I said, yes, well, they're having another one at such and such a place. That would have been the preparatory lecture, you know. So I went to that.
And talk about determinism.
Yeah. Yeah, as I wrote that, reminds me, a conversational memoir, that hit me over and over and over again, that everything seemed to fall into place. Mother Divine was running the whole show. We all think that we are doing it most of the time, and we wonder, should we do it this way, should we do it that way, and then we do the best we can.
Yeah, well, we're getting on a plane, and that seems to us to be a big deal.
Yeah.
But the destination of the plane is a far bigger deal than our getting on it.
That's
plane has already made plans, they've got their pilot, they've got their, you know, their crew, they know where they're going, and you just walk on the plane.
That's a wonderful way to put it. You can relax, in other words. And with Maharshi says, take it easy, take it as it comes. He doesn't say make it come.
As it comes.
So you taught for a while, didn't you? After you learned TM and then you went to teacher training?
Right, yeah. I went to teacher training in Switzerland. It was just wonderful. And I remember how eager we were. Golly, you would have just, we were just so determined to become teachers. I think we would have jumped over the shoulders of our grandmother if we'd had to get on a plane, you know. And so then I taught in Laguna Beach. I think I taught to over 250 people in this little town of 16,000, not much bigger than Fairfield. And then I taught some people in Chapel Hill. And then I became a sitta in 76. Then I taught, I also taught my father and my, I didn't teach my mother, but I arranged for her to be taught. And I taught my aunt and my sister. I was, I wanted her and her husband to learn, and he decided that he'd put it off, and maybe later, but I told my sister that I think it'd be worth her while to do it. And by golly, she went and did it, and to this day is never, I don't think she ever misses. So I'm really, really, really pleased. You know how it is when you see someone do something that you know is good
for them,
yeah,
yes,
that they'll enjoy and that's good for them. It gives you, especially with your parents, if you can get that going. And so I was very pleased when that was taken care of itself, you know. I asked Dad sometimes, I'd say, well, have you been meditating your two a day? And he said, sometimes three. That was very much in his nature. If he saw a good thing, he would just go for it.
Well, from the Amana colonies to the Navy to Hollywood and to MUM, what a journey.
What a journey.
Yeah. Well, and MUM, of course. When I left to go to New York, by the way, to do theater arts and all that, I really thought it would be unlikely that I would ever live in Iowa again. You know, I'd come back and visit. And I did for some years. And then suddenly there was this university here. Well, you know, it just pulls at you. So here I am.
Well, from
and here you'll stay, we hope. Yes.
We really enjoy your company here. Mm-hmm. Now, the successful writer that you are, what advice would you give a young aspiring writer these days?
Well, if you're really interested in writing, I would have them do just what I did, which is to have in mind to do it. If your circumstances are that you can do a lot of it now, do a lot. If it's just a little, then keep a little notebook. And every time you have a thought, you think, gee, this is a cute little anecdote. Mm-hmm. Put that little anecdote. I did this, by the way, for years. And put that down and say, or if you think a book on the child stars, you know, might be an interesting idea. Put it down. Put down all these little thoughts that might be useful at some point, because that's your first version of anything that you're ever going to do. So do it. And it's fun to do, and it's easy. So I would do that. And then if you become really interested and you want to take the time to write a book, then I would simply write the book. And I would do it, and one of the reasons that I'm so glad I wrote the book is that in doing it, I learned that is an easy way to do it is the way I did it. Now, mind you, you may decide to do what I did to a certain degree. In other words, I went to the typewriter, to the computer, and simply started typing, and whatever thoughts came, I just continued until I had finished everything I felt I had to say. And so it was all a jumble, in a sense, because I jumped from one time to another time to a different chronology, 40 years ago. So I'd have, when I then went through and I edited it, and then I could make it a little clearer, and so on and so forth, and divide it into chapters and so on and so forth. But that you can all do. It's easy to do. First, get everything down. Then start your various ways of looking at it to see how you want to organize it. Maybe you don't want to do it as mine was, a reminder that reminds me. Maybe you want to do it A, B, C, D, E. The way it happened chronologically. That's the way, tried and true, it's been done a million times, and you can do it that way too. So you can decide to do it that way. Or, and that's an easy way to do it, by the way, because you always know where you went to school, you know where you went to college, you know what your first job was, you know when you started. So you can do that. And it's all right, fine. Or you may find that as you go along, you have an idea within your life that is a book in itself. Maybe a marriage, or maybe a non-marriage, you know, maybe a marriage that you learned something from that didn't last, but that made something that's a whole book within this book, and you can let all the rest go, because all the rest will fall into place. Because it'll have some, you'll use it, you'll find a way to use everything. If once you've decided you're going to be a writer, everything is useful. And you'll find a way. You don't waste anything. You'll become very protective of all that material. And you say, why waste this? You know, I could write an article about this later on. And you could get a commission from a magazine, New Yorker pays $1 a word. Used to, it's probably two by now. And so, and they take long articles, so you can get $20,000 for an article.
Wow.
So
what's on the burner now for you? What do you got going?
That's a very, very good question. I'm taking suggestions at this point.
Well, this has been a wonderful experience, and especially a seasoned writer like yourself. I hope young aspiring writers will hear this, because I think it can be very useful to them.
That's one of my goals for it. I'm so glad that you're giving it that airing, because I think it's very useful for people to have some of the things we talked about. And by the way, if they want the book, you might. Is it okay to mention?
Yes, absolutely. Where can they get it?
They can get it at on Amazon or Barnes and Noble and Kindle. Mm-hmm. And we have, if someone wants to just call my office, we have a few discounted copies if anyone wants to get one, just without having to bother going to the mails, which cost a little more.
Very good. And if someone were interested in your previous works, are they available?
I've been published on four continents, but I'm largely out of print. There's the one that is the Moguls is just now going into a new printing. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, it's the memoir that I think would be the one to go for, which will tell you a little bit about all the others.
Well, it's been very wonderful.
Well,
I hope we get a chance to do this again about your newer book.
Well, all right, fine. Thank you. You let me ramble on, and I hope you'll edit it down nicely.
I might have to call in a good editor. I know
Norman. That's right.
Get it from... How many hours down?
Well, actually, I will have to admit, I absolutely adore editing. Yeah. I love editing. Editing to me is so easy. You know, it's all there already.
Yeah.
All you're doing is just manicuring.
Trimming it down.
And you get such a feeling of satisfaction from that. I have worked a lot with Ken Chalkin, and we both picked this up kind of at the same time. Mm-hmm. That... We both decided that editing is the way to go. It's really just fun.
Well, this is very good.
It's just absolutely fabulous talking to you and hearing about these experiences. And
thanks so much.
There's a lot. You touched on some of the things in the book, but there's so much more in the book.
Yeah,
I really encourage everyone to read it.
Oh my gosh, the book is a goldmine for writers.
Yeah, for stories. And
well. That's one of my goals. I'm so glad you say that, because that makes me... I felt when I'd finished it, I at first thought, I'm not going to publish this. You know, I've cleared it out of my system now. And then you also think, oh, well, you know, I say a lot of things about my mother and my father, and should I say them or not? But then I decided that I'd done it in a way that was acceptable. So I accept... found that was all right. So I think that another reason that I published it was for my family. I thought it would be awfully nice if everyone has a family, and there will be generations coming. And isn't it nice? I would love to have a book, a little memoir of one of my grandparents, you know, when they came from Ohio to join the Amana community, you know. And brought all their belongings and deposited them and joined a communal group. And so I think that there's a value in writing about a memoir, an autobiography for the family. And then I thought also because I talk about TM in a way that is different than in many books, because many books will tell about TM, but it's in a straightforward way. But this puts it in the context of a life, you know, and it shows how it works in an individual, which makes it interesting, I think, to read. And also, I think, might be helpful to someone, for example, I would like some of my relatives to read this who have not started, because they have reservations. But if they see how it fits into a life, and that it, that only good comes of it, and that it doesn't involve, you know, you don't have to worry about religion being different or anything like that. It's, it goes with any religion and so on and so forth. So I think it it might be really useful. I think that it would be, if a lot of people read this who didn't know anything about TM, I would swear that some of them would go for an introductory lecture.
I'm sure, absolutely. You know? Yeah, because all you have to do is hear about it and see how it affects someone, and then you think, maybe something for me.
It opens that door a little bit.
Yeah, maybe is all that you need.
Yeah.
Maybe they will hear this on KHOE.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Because, you know, we're world, we broadcast worldwide, in Alaska.
Good Lord, I didn't.
In South America, in South Africa.
Do you
just
get...
Yes, just www.khoe.org and click on Listen Now, and they're hearing the same thing that we hear in Fairfield.
Wow. That's wonderful, isn't it?
And media is a wonderful thing.
It's just amazing.
Worldwide.
It's the good parts are so wonderful if we can just get full control of the difficult parts.
Well, this is something that will be good. This interview, people will really enjoy hearing your stories. Mm-hmm.
Well, wonderful. I'm very pleased to have come. And I think that it gestated just long enough for it to flow easily.
Well, I think we made a little history here and told a little history that you can find in the book. And we want to thank our KHOE listeners for tuning in to KHOE and to, like I said, worldwide, www.khoe.org, and to the program What's New on Campus. And thank you, Dean of Faculty Kathy Guarini, for being with us. You've added your wonderful, wonderful flavor of knowledge to what we're doing here, and we're really thankful for that. So thank you, Norman, and thank you, Kathy, and thank you for joining us, our KHOE listeners.
Wonderful.